Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome, everybody. You all know that I have no interest whatsoever, no intention whatsoever, no motivation whatsoever to deceive you about the believability or the trustworthiness of anybody, but in particular in the context of the January 6th committee investigating the Trump riots. I have no interest in telling you that a witness is any more or less credible than they actually are. And in a few minutes, we're going to look at a specific claim made by former aide to former Trump chief of staff Mark Meadows, Cassidy Hutchinson. We're going to look at a specific claim she made that's being disputed. And we will discuss, is this plausible? Who do we think is telling the truth? We're going to look at that. And she may have said something that wasn't true. We'll figure it out. But first, we have to talk about these brazen and completely baseless smears that have launched against Cassidy Hutchinson. And it's a really great insight into how a propaganda outlet, in this case, Breitbart, the right wing propaganda outlet Breitbart, can generate what looks like a news story based on nothing. Headline from this morning, Breitbart report. Cassidy Hutchinson fabricated testimony about conversation with former White House counsel Pat Cipollone. Whoa, report. This must be pretty serious. You start reading the article and you will very quickly see what this is about. The article reads, Cassidy Hutchinson, a former White House aide who was the January 6th committee's star witness during a surprise hearing held on Tuesday, reportedly fabricated pieces of her testimony about conversations she had with former White House counsel Pat Cipollone. Okay. During her testimony, Hutchinson claimed that Cipollone told her to tell her boss, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, that former President Trump should not go to the Capitol on January 6th. That's true. She did testify to that. Hutchinson testified Cipollone said, we're going to get charged with every crime imaginable if Trump went to the Capitol. The committee's vice chair, Liz Cheney, doubled down on her calls to get Cipollone to testify before the committee due to Hutchinson's testimony. As we heard yesterday, White House counsel Pat Cipollone had significant concerns about Trump's activities on January 6th. Cheney tweeted, it's time for Mr. Cipollone to testify on the record. Any concerns he has about the institutional interests of his prior office are outweighed by the need for his testimony. That's true. They have now subpoenaed Pat Cipollone, and we will get to that. But then it starts to get a little weird. The Breitbart article reads, however, Cipollone was reportedly not at the White House on the morning of January 6th. According to Human Events senior editor Jack Posobiec. Uh-oh. And then you look, what is the source of this report? And it is tweets from a conspiracy theorist, Jack Posobiec. That's the source. Jack Posobiec tweeted, apropos of nothing, citing no sources. Breaking, multiple sources, including one who was at the White House on January 6th, tell me Cipollone was not there in the AM when Hutchinson testified she spoke with him. January 6th committee is aware of this discrepancy and are ignoring media inquiries about it. Seems she made up the entire conversation. Okay, this is an example of the collapse of journalism. Now, remember, I don't do journalism. I do commentary. I'm not a reporter. Okay, and so when I tell you where am I getting a story, I tell you, I'm getting this from a news reporting agency, or I'm getting this from an opinion person, or whatever the case may be. Breitbart claims to be doing news and reporting. And when you look, they are just citing a tweet from a conspiracy theorist. That's it. That's the whole basis. Anybody who has worked at an actual journalism institution would know there are standards and practices, and no serious journalism outfit would publish such a story based on a tweet from a conspiracy theorist. That's all it is. That's all that this is. There's nothing there. There's just nothing there. And when someone in Trump's orbit is trying to gather information to discredit a witness. And everybody's insisting on anonymity. And none of them actually show up to testify under oath. And maybe some of them will, and then I'll change my perspective. When you publish something like this, you are becoming a node or a signal booster of disinformation. And by the way, it's disinformation all in the service of defending and running interference for those who tried to completely subvert the democracy of the United States. But I guess it generates clicks. I don't know. Now, if Secret Service wants to testify under oath, whatever, if they want to do that, then let's listen to them. And then we will have two competing under oath statements to evaluate and compare. OK, right now we have the under oath testimony of Cassidy Hutchinson. And then we have, you know, unsourced tweets, vague statements about we would be willing to dispute elements of her testimony, but nobody's actually shown up under oath despite being invited by the January 6th committee. So that's what this is. This is pond scum. Now, let's get to a more substantive claim about something Cassidy Hutchinson said, which is being contradicted specifically and narrowly. OK, so let's now move away from the unsourced conspiracy smears against Cassidy Hutchinson, the January 6th committee witness, and let's look at a specific claim that's being made about something she said that is allegedly not true. There are now reports that the note that was put up on the screen during Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony, which she said, I wrote that, that's my handwriting. There is a contradictory claim being made that that is not her handwriting. So let's evaluate this. This would be this is specific and substantive. So, and it's sourced. So there's no issue here with evaluating it. ABC News reports Trump White House attorney disputes Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony about a handwritten note. Former Trump White House lawyer Eric Hirschman is claiming that a handwritten note regarding a potential statement for then President Donald Trump to release during the January 6th attack was written by him during a meeting at the White House that afternoon, not by Cassidy Hutchinson. Sources familiar with the matter tell ABC News. So what's this all about? At Tuesday's January 6th committee hearing, Liz Cheney displayed a note which Hutchinson said, I wrote that. She saw it and she said, that's my handwriting. I wrote that. Sources familiar with the matter say that Eric Hirschman, an attorney, had previously told the committee he wrote the note. A spokesperson for Hirschman said to ABC News Tuesday night, quote, the handwritten note that Cassidy Hutchinson testified was written by her was in fact written by Eric Hirschman on January 6, 2021. All sources with direct knowledge and law enforcement have and will confirm that it was written by Mr. Hirschman. At the hearing on Tuesday, Hutchinson testified about the note, quote, that's a note that I wrote at the direction of the chief of staff on January 6th, likely around 3 o'clock. Liz Cheney asked, and it's written on the chief of staff note card, but that's your handwriting, Ms. Hutchinson? And Ms. Hutchinson said, that's my handwriting. Okay, this is a specific disagreement, and it is not really subject to the squishiness of some of the other claims. Well, we're willing to testify that the claim about Trump trying to grab the wheel didn't happen. Well, how can you testify something didn't happen if you? OK, that's sort of like squishy and subject to some kind of interpretation. This is just like, whose handwriting is it? Who wrote the note? And if she didn't write the note, you know, people tend to know their own handwriting. When I look, you know, down here, I have all sorts of copious notes on a legal pad. I can immediately see that this is all my handwriting. If I saw different handwriting, it would be very evident to me. People tend to be very well acquainted with their own handwriting. She said it was her handwriting. Someone else is saying, no, I wrote that. Well, let's figure it out. And if she was wrong about that, we would want to know, did she deliberately lie about that? Was she confused about her own handwriting, which would be weird? It would be something to figure out. But understand that every aspect of this is being used simply to attack her by people who barely even know who she is. As an example, Sean Hannity last night seized on this entire handwriting thing. And he said, did Catherine really write it? Her name's Cassidy. They don't even know her name. They don't care. They just want to attack.
Bring in a handwriting. I bring in handwriting experts, and they can determine was it Hirschman or was it the woman from yesterday, Catherine.
Right. Was it Catherine who wrote it? Well, Sean, it was not Catherine who wrote it because no one named Catherine is involved here. They don't even know her name. But to the extent that this is a substantive claim, is it her handwriting? Is it someone else's? Eric Hirschman says, I wrote that. Let's figure out who wrote it, and then let's figure out what the confusion is. No problem with that whatsoever. All right, major steps being taken now. The January 6th committee has subpoenaed Trump's former White House lawyer, Pat Cipollone. Pat Cipollone is a name that made headlines on Tuesday, in part because the closed captioning could not handle the name Pat Cipollone. At one point, the closed captioning during Tuesday's hearing said Patsy Bologna or Patsy Bologna in other cases. So everybody knows the name Pat Cipollone now. Pat Cipollone has been subpoenaed to testify. The Guardian reports January 6th committee subpoenas former White House counsel Pat Cipollone. Donald Trump's former counsel was a key witness to some of the ex-president's most brazen schemes to overturn the 2020 election. Why do we care about this? We care about this because many of the claims being made by others who have testified in front of the January 6th committee are claims about what Pat Cipollone said and what Pat Cipollone told others. For example, they're going to charge us with every crime in the book or something like that if we do this, if we make this attempt to steal the election. Well, it would be really great to get him under oath. Did he say that? Did he believe that? What was his assessment of what Donald Trump was trying to do? The House Select Committee has issued a subpoena compelling him to testify about at least three parts of Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election results. The subpoena marked a dramatic escalation for the panel and showed its resolve in seeking to obtain inside information about how Trump sought to return himself to office. Mr. Cipollone repeatedly raised legal and other concerns about Trump's activities on January 6th and the days that preceded. The committee needs to hear from him on the record, as other former White House counsels have done in other congressional investigations. Cipollone was a key witness to some of Trump's most brazen schemes, which the Select Committee said in its hearings was part of a sprawling and potentially unlawful multi-pronged strategy culminating in the Capitol attack. Cipollone has information about Trump's push to send fake slates of electors to Congress, the subpoena letter said. So is he going to testify? We don't know. Every indication so far has been that folks like Cipollone have no interest in being put under oath and answering direct questions about what took place on January 6th, January 5th, and the days approaching it. He should testify. I hope he cooperates. I hope he doesn't take the Steve Bannon route. And if we are able to, you know, the problem we're having right now is you get someone at every instance. The sequence is like this. There's the initial sort of framework for the January 6th committee. Republicans say, we don't like it. We're not participating. Okay, so then it forces Democrats to say, are there any Republicans willing to be on this committee? And Adam Kinzinger says, I'll do it. And Liz Cheney says, I'll do it. And then Republicans say, well, look, they barely have Republicans on the committee. Well, but that's by your choice. Then they get witnesses to testify. Cassidy Hutchinson and others testify, and they make claims under oath, under tremendous legal pressure, under tremendous societal pressure. She now needs security, on and on and on, getting threats. And then in the media, oh, well, we're willing to have a different to put forth our perspective, which contradicts Cassidy Hutchinson's. OK, we'll show up and do it under oath. Well, they're not willing to have us. Yes, they are. They said at the end of the hearing, anyone else who has light to shed on these incidents, please come forward. We would like you to testify. Well, where are they? It's now been 48 hours. Nobody has been scheduled to testify as of yet. Bring them in. And so there's this constant attempt to say, well, here's a claim made under oath. Here's something someone said to someone on Twitter. They cancel out. So we don't know what the truth is. Well, no, hold on a second. The statements made under oath attributed to individuals should carry more weight than the random musings of someone saying, I would show up and say something different. Show up, take the oath and say something different, and then we will evaluate it. Let me know on Twitter, where you can find me at @dpacman. Do you think any of these supposed contradictors are actually going to show up and make contradictory statements under oath? Let me know. We'll take a quick break and be right back. The David Pakman Show depends on the support of our audience. Our primary source of funding is the membership program we have on our website, joinpakman.com. We do an extra show every day called The Bonus Show for our members.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money. Everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Well, okay, I wouldn't call it quite so bad. It's just an extra show, Alex, but thank you. You can sign up at joinpakman.com and you can use the coupon code BIGVOTING22 to get a sizable discount off of the cost of a membership. Hope to see you on today's bonus show. Ginny Thomas's lawyer says she's just too stressed out to testify because of what's going on in the United States today. Yes, it's beyond parody. So let's back up a little bit. Clarence Thomas is a Supreme Court justice. Ginny Thomas is the wife of Clarence Thomas. Ginny Thomas, we now know, was very much involved in the fake elector scheme of the 2022 election, trying to send fake electors to Washington, D.C. to vote for Trump instead of Joe Biden, despite Joe Biden having won their state. This includes Arizona. She was heavily involved in the lead up to the January 6th rally that Donald Trump did before the riot. Ginny Thomas is very involved. And this also puts Clarence Thomas in a potentially compromising position where many are saying he should really recuse himself from anything even remotely having to do with the 2020 election. The January 6th committee now wants to hear from her. And her lawyer says, guys, she's just too stressed out. And this is only days after she said she was eager to testify. Yet again, oh, I want to tell my side. OK, well, show up and swear an oath. Oh, I'm too stressed. Now I can't do it. Business Insider reports Ginny Thomas's lawyer tries to get her out of the January 6th panel testimony, saying it's been a particularly stressful time amid all of these Supreme Court rulings. You've got to be kidding me. The attorney for Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, questioned the need for her testimony before the January 6th committee and said it had been a, quote, particularly stressful time. Oh, poor thing. Amid recent Supreme Court rulings. The House committee investigating the Capitol riot requested a voluntary interview with Thomas earlier this month over her efforts to overturn the 2020 election. She didn't formally accept the invitation, but she said 2 weeks ago she, quote, can't wait to speak to the panel. OK, but in an 8-page letter sent on Tuesday, Thomas's attorney, Mark Paletta, wrote he had, quote, serious concerns about the interview, asked the committee to, quote, provide a better justification for why her testimony would be relevant, and added in his letter, I would also note that this has been a particularly stressful time as the Thomases have been subjected to an avalanche of death threats and other abuse by the unprecedented assault on the conservative Supreme Court justices and their families. Oh, guys, it's just too stressful for her right now. But of course, remember, Ginny Thomas, 14 days ago, I can't wait to talk to the January 6th committee and will, quote, clear up misconceptions. It sounds like 2 weeks ago, she saw the opportunity to testify, it wasn't even to testify, it was an informal interview, to speak to the January 6th committee as maybe a stress reducing thing. I would love to show up. It would be so good for me to reduce and clear up misconceptions about my involvement. Cut to this week. Oh, it's just way too stressful for her. Way too stressful. Well, why not clear up the misconceptions? Maybe the misconceptions aren't really misconceptions. Maybe she really was as involved as it's believed in the attempts to overturn the 2020 election. Did Clarence Thomas say, oh, hell no, you can't do that? That's insane. Did her lawyer say, you know, if you give this informal interview, the next step is the committee might say, well, we need you to testify under oath. And then if you don't, then they might subpoena you. And maybe the conversation would reveal additional information that's bad for Clarence Thomas. Guys, she's married to a Supreme Court justice. She must have known that this all could lead towards sworn testimony in which she would be bound to tell the truth. And this is straight out of the Trump playbook. Remember that one of the classics of the Trump playbook is the principle. It was often Trump who would do it. He would say, hell yeah, I'll show up. I'll clear all this up. And it's because Trump thinks he's smarter than everybody in the room. Trump thinks he can lie and give his false version of events and everybody's going to fall for it. Nobody's going to realize that the guy is lying. And then lawyers say, oh, there is no way you're showing up and testifying under oath. Remember that with the Russia probe, this was a thing. Trump kept saying, I can show up and I'm going to tell them what's what. And of course, every lawyer said, oh, dear God, this guy lies uncontrollably. If he shows up and lies, that's what others are getting indicted and charged for and found guilty of. You can't do that. You tell everyone just how eager you are to share your information. You tell everybody how eager you are to clarify. And then later, someone else says, oh, yeah, no, here's the thing. She's really stressed out, guys. She can't show up. And that's exactly what happened with Trump in the Russia probe. And listen, I'm open to seeing, do these Secret Service agents testify? Do other aides to high-level Trump staff come in and contradict the testimony of Cassidy Hutchinson? Bring them in, put them under oath, and then we'll keep it. We'll consider it on an equal playing field. Otherwise, it's just media nonsense. And the latest is Ginny Thomas is just too stressed out to show up and clear up everything. Just, we're wrong about everything we've said about her, and she would love to clear it up, but it's just too stressful for her right now. Give me a break. Donald Trump is now apparently turning not only on Fox News, but also on Newsmax. Donald Trump appeared on Newsmax last night, and he said the election is stolen, and Fox News no longer talks about it, and Newsmax no longer talks about it. He says, I guess that they're afraid. And he even says to the Newsmax host, I bet you guys are going to cut what I'm saying right now. And the host says, no, 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 we're not going to cut it. Check this out. Trump's furious with anyone who won't uncritically repeat his baseless and false claims. Check this out.
Look at the dishonesty of this committee.
Right.
They don't talk about any of the things that refute January 6th. They don't talk about the election numbers. They don't analyze the election. The people were there because the election was rigged and stolen. So what they should be doing is trying to convince people that it wasn't. You do that through analyzing the numbers. They don't want to do that. In fact, they don't even want to hear that. And Fox doesn't put it on. And by the way, you people don't put it on either. You're afraid of being sued or something. I don't know. Someday you'll have to explain that.
This is.
Yeah, well, at a certain point, you can only lie so much before you're potentially in legal jeopardy. That's true. It is. Everything Trump is saying isn't true.
In fact, they'll probably cut what I'm saying out
of course
right
not.
Now out
of Newsmax. No, of course not. This will be on Wake Up
don't
America
it,
tomorrow
don't
morning,
let it
sir. Absolutely not.
Good. Get it
no,
done
I will
fast.
Not allow that.
Get it
yes.
done fast before Chris sees it, okay? But they might cut it out, and let's yeah. just see. I hope they put it on.
Yep.
But this was about a rigged and stolen election.
Now, that's not actually what the committee is about. Understand, it's when Trump says the committee won't investigate this other thing. It's sort of like saying this committee refuses to talk about the rash of thefts of catalytic converters from Priuses. Well, OK, that's not the focus of the committee. The thefts of catalytic converters also happens to be a real thing, whereas the theft of the election is imaginary. But it's not what the committee is there to do.
That millions and millions of people felt is true.
Right. And of course, facts don't care about your feelings. But Trump continues to repeat, people feel the election was stolen. People feel it was stolen. And Fox News no longer talks about it. And Newsmax no longer talks about it. They talked about it for months. They talked about it for months. And there's nothing there. Now, what Trump is really saying when he says this is media outlets that are supposed to be friendly to me aren't doing enough heavy lifting on the lies that I am trying to perpetuate. That's the translation for what Trump is saying here. Interestingly, Trump was also asked during this interview about the allegations made by Cassidy Hutchinson that he lunged at a Secret Service agent and tried to commandeer the vehicle. Trump's explanation for why it's not true is sort of that he's too fat to do the thing he was accused of doing. Listen carefully here.
And they put her on. And they don't even confirm it with the Secret Service. The Secret Service people in the car said this didn't happen. But you don't even need that.
Now, remember, they have not testified under oath. There is a report through the grapevine that some Secret Service agent is willing to contradict some of what Cassidy Hutchinson said. None of it has actually happened yet. But OK, let's continue.
Who would do that? I would grab a Secret Service person by the throat.
I don't even know if it's possible. Certainly not in the Beast.
It's very hard.
Even in one of the SUVs.
Well, it's very hard for another reason. These guys lift 350 pounds.
Right. I saw you get out of the SUV.
So when Trump says these guys lift 350 pounds and I don't, What he's saying is he's out of shape. What he's saying is he's obese. What he's saying is it would be a stupid thing to do to try to do anything. But Trump does stupid things all the time. Narcissists overstate their they overbelieve. They are falsely confident in all of their abilities, not only their intelligence, but maybe also their physical abilities. And by the way, notice that what was said there, the beast versus SUVs. Initially, the claim was in the beast, meaning the presidential limo. Trump is sitting so far from the driver that he couldn't do the thing Cassidy Hutchinson accused him of doing. But when you look at the video of that day, if I recall correctly, Trump is actually leaving in an SUV. It's a different vehicle completely. So when Laura Ingraham and others say, you can't do that in the limo, the video seems to show Trump in an SUV. All right, let's look at the last bit of this.
Tonight, it seemed like it was pretty smooth.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I mean, but, you know, these are people. These are great people. These are great people. They've devoted their lives to it. And I think they were very embarrassed by it because it makes them sound terrible.
Tony Ornato and Bobby Engel.
They're great. I know them very well.
Sterling.
They are sterling. And it was very nice that they came to my defense. I thought it was incredible, actually.
Now, remember, there are allegations that they would come to Trump's defense. They have not actually done it yet in any kind of significant way.
Because, you know, some whack job can say this stuff and get away with it. And other things, that I wanted guns at my rally. Okay, now I'm speaking. Why would I want guns? I don't want people standing with guns in my rally.
Oh, so guns are dangerous. Now, wow, okay. I mean, if he believes guns everywhere make everybody safer, why wouldn't he want the gun? It's all a verbal inkblot test. But Trump now upset with Fox that they won't do his carry water on his election lies, upset that Newsmax won't, even though they kind of do, but just not to that degree. And Trump essentially saying, I'm not in shape enough to do the thing that I was accused of doing. Make of it what you will. We'll have these clips on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Joe Henrich, who's professor of human evolutionary biology at Harvard University and also author of the book, The Weirdest People in the World, How the West Became Psychologically Peculiar and Particularly Prosperous. It's really great having you on today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, good to be with you.
So let's first talk about WEIRD is an acronym, W-E-I-R-D, for Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. So how did you first start to sort of think about this group of people as a group of people and sort of what the defining characteristics are?
Yeah, so around 2006 or so, I began working with two cultural psychologists, Steve Heine and R. Noren Zion, at the University of British Columbia. And, you know, we had come together over lunch and stuff and began to talk about our research. And what we each had realized somewhat independently was not only was there cultural variation around the world and key aspects of psychology, but that the populations most commonly studied by psychologists and others were unusual when seated in that global perspective. So they were often at the tail end of the distribution or, you know, distinctively set apart from other populations. Mm. So we came up with the idea of writing a paper together, The Weirdest People in the World, meant to raise an alarm, kind of a methodological concern aimed at psychologists and others that they were overgeneralizing from the populations that they studied, that they couldn't make assumptions about human behavior by studying American undergraduates or people online, people from those sources. And then as a way of referring to the populations most commonly studied by researchers, we came up with the acronym WEIRD, just as a way, and it's meant as a consciousness-raising device to kind of remind researchers that they should be cautious about generalizing.
So when we talk about the characteristics, Western makes sense, educated makes sense, industrialized, rich and democratic. When we talk about rich, are we talking about rich at a global scale, or are we saying even within these Western countries, we're talking about the rich?
Well, I mean, what we had in mind was mostly psychologists were sampling undergrad at the time. They were mostly sampling undergraduates from a small handful of countries. So the U.S., Canada, a couple places in Europe, Australia, places like that. So, you know, to the degree to which American undergraduates tend to be disproportionately sampled from the middle and upper class, yeah. So in that case, it leaves out lower SES And then, of course, globally, those are among the richest countries in the world.
Before we move on to some of the other aspects of your research, it's often repeated, and things that are often repeated aren't necessarily true, but it's often repeated that if you compare folks from the large cities in the United States to the rest of the U.S. and then compare them to people from places like London and Paris, et cetera, that the folks from large cities across these countries are much more similar than those within the United States living in urban versus rural settings, for example. Do you think in your research, does that sound right to you, or does that maybe miss some important things?
Well, it definitely misses some important things. So in putting together the evidence that, you know, we were able to gather, you can compare, corporate managers or executives from around the world working at, you know, leading productive companies. And you can detect the same kind of psychological variation you can get if you compare, you know, the groups from lower socioeconomic status or, you know, more representative populations of these countries.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, in the title of the book, you use the term psychologically peculiar. Peculiar can just mean unique and different, but it can also mean that the sort of something maybe that we would identify as strange or unusual. What are the psychological peculiarities of this group that is often the source for studies?
Yeah, so the key thing I wanted to focus on was trying to understand the psychological variation we find around across populations around the globe. So some of the key dimensions that emerged were, one is a kind of psychological cluster or complex called individualism.
Mm-hmm.
That's associated with how people think about themselves, about overconfidence and self-esteem, and the role of guilt versus shame. And so there's a whole cluster there where people in weird societies tend to think about themselves as unitary individual decision makers rather than nodes in a social network. They tend to be overconfident. They tend to have concerns about guilt, but shame is relatively unimportant. This goes along with another pattern, which is analytic versus holistic thinking. So there tends to be an inclination towards more analytic thinking, so breaking problems down into parts, assigning properties to those parts, and then reasoning from that point of view, as opposed to looking at the relationships among parts to make explanations. So we find lots of variation there. The use of intentionality and moral judgments seems to be another one. So lots of Westerners really think intentions are important, but in other places, you know, intentions don't seem to be important at all, at least in making some moral judgments. Moral universalism, so the degree to which you think everyone should be judged by the same moral standards versus moral particularism, where you make a difference between how people within some circle should be judged versus people outside that circle. Trust in strangers is another important one, things like that.
What are the sources of these peculiarities? I mean, is it media? Is it the characteristics themselves, like being, you know, rich or industrialized or whatever the case may be? Does religion and or churches play a role? What causes this?
Well, I mean, there's probably lots of factors that affect overall global psychological variation. But in the book, I was particularly interested in trying to understand why it was that European and European descent populations became particularly individualistic. And particularly have a strong impersonal pro-sociality, so this trust and cooperation with strangers, which should be contrasted with a more interpersonal pro-sociality where people are much more cooperative and positively inclined towards people they know, people they have relationships with, that kind of thing, within group loyalty. So the case that I make is that much of the kind of unusual nature of European society as it emerged in the last 500 years comes from a particular set of taboos and prescriptions that one branch of Christianity, the one that evolves into the Roman Catholic Church, began to promulgate in late antiquity and eventually, although gradually, spreads throughout many parts of Western Europe and transforms the intensive, complex kinship organizations that you would find in many pre-Christian European societies and breaks them down into monogamous nuclear families. And then this opens the door for other kinds of institutions, impersonal institutions, Eventually, things like democracy and Western law and whatnot. But initially, things like guilds, universities, monasteries that were organized differently and built around notions of individuals trying to attract individuals. So it really puts these populations on a different kind of cultural evolutionary trajectory than we see in many societies around the world and back into history.
So in if I understand correctly, even though today in the United States, for example, Roman Catholics are not a majority, the evolution and growth of the Roman Catholic Church starting 500 years ago in Europe led to, in a sense, psychological changes, which include acceptance of certain types of relationships to institutions that are still very relevant today in terms of how this group you study relates to the world.
That's right. You should think of that, the stuff the Catholic Church did, as initiating a kind of cultural evolutionary process. Hmm. And then these principles get to varying degrees embedded in secular institutions and become part of the general cultural milieu. One of the cases I make in the book is that this process led to the emergence of Protestantism. So, you know, there's this goes on for 1,000 years before Martin Luther and others initiate this Protestant Reformation, which, of course, is a constellation, a mosaic of different religious movements that are rebelling against the Catholic Church. But, I mean, they have sort of super weird characteristics in the sense that they're really focused on mental states, the role of intentionality, centrality on the individual, emphasis on hard work, deferral of gratification. So it only further accentuates some of the basic characteristics that had been developing prior to that.
You know, some of the characteristics you write about and that you've spoken about, high level of individualism, maybe analytical to some degree in a way that's not as common in other societies or in other parts of society, nonconformism, etc. I will often hear from people when they visit a country that is outside of this group, you know, friends who have done work in Southeast Asia or have gone to Africa, etc. And they seem to very quickly pick up on the fact that there's just sort of like something different about the perspective on the world around them that has to do with some of the traits that you're pointing out here. So it seems as though part of the reason many who are part of this weird group aren't aware of this is they're just around people like themselves all the time. In other words, we have the ability to notice when folks are different. We maybe just aren't spending enough time around them, but that once you do, you realize that there is some kind of cultural difference here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that's the real value to traveling and living in other societies. So, you know, I come up as an anthropologist. So as a cultural anthropologist, I got to live in Amazonia in small communities. I did a long stretch of field work in the South Pacific on remote islands and, you know, really tried to dig in and live among the people. And to the degree to which other people did that for other reasons, it really does kind of, you know, it's like a fish out of water or something. You really then begin to notice the lack of water around you or the striking difference that you don't see unless you get removed from the water.
Is it hard to understand some of these things just by being told about them? Because what my mind is going to is, if you read some of Jared Diamond's books, for example, where he talks extensively about his time spent in the Pacific with the Maori people, etc., when you just read his descriptions of the culture, yes, it's different. But I can only imagine that the degree to which you can really feel that partially has to be from actually being there thousands of miles from where you normally are and sort of being told about this phenomena can only really do so much.
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways to get at it. So, of course, you know, living with people and learning the language and trying to really engage in the society is the best way to get a feel for it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there are, you know, I guess, not, you know, things like novels can try to bring you and put you in the shoes of someone living in that society, you know, an honor society where you're very concerned about maintaining your honor because that protects your family and it's core to your identity as a person. So that's another way. And then, of course, you know, some amount of travel can at least give you a feel for it.
Are any of the distinctions that you study, can value judgments be assigned to them to some degree in terms of either what's, quote, better for the individuals within or for the groups and societies at a whole? Or is this merely we're observing differences and that's as far as it goes?
Well, so my mission in the book was just to well, kind of start out by documenting the differences, but the thing I was really interested in doing is explaining the variation and cueing to my readers, many of which I sort of assumed as I wrote the book would be mostly weird. So I was trying to jar them in ways that would make them recognize the water, so to speak, so recognize the sort of psychological differences. So when I talk about analytic thinking, you know, analytic thinking can be very powerful, breaking things down into parts and assigning them properties. It's really the basis of how, you know, what physics is, right? Break everything down into particles and give them charges or spin or charge or something like that. And then explain everything from that. Psychologists give people personalities and try to explain that. Economists do a similar thing. So it's very powerful, but you can miss the forest. So like some of the subsections in the book are like missing the forest, reminding people that if you're too much of an analytic thinker, you can miss how all the parts fit together and how the relationships are so important. So for example, when psychologists do work on what leads to effective problem solving in teams, the best teams at solving problems and engaging in creativity are teams that have a mixture of analytic and holistic thinkers. So you need both growth groups. Towards the end of the book, I really emphasize the role of embracing cultural differences for generating innovation. So most innovations are recombinations of existing ideas. And so the degree to which you can get people with very different ideas, different ways of seeing the world, to interact in mutually trusting and potentially cooperative and beneficial ways, you're just going to generate more innovation. So one of the things I've been researching lately is the degree to which immigration energized economic growth and innovation patenting within the United States.
You talk in the book about delayed gratification and differences among different societies on delayed gratification. Many of us have probably heard of these studies that were done on little kids where, you know, they say, well, I'm going to put a cookie in front of you and I'm going to leave. And if you don't eat it, I'll give you a second cookie later. And you kind of evaluate, you know, who does what. I think to some degree, in weird societies, as defined by you, being able to delay gratification is seen as objectively good. And that may not always be the case, but it seems as though it's seen as sort of like a virtue in some sense, being able to delay gratification. And one of the things you find is that not delaying gratification is more common among non-weird people. Is that a place where there's actually sort of like logical explanations for why it's not objectively better to delay gratification if you consider the context, maybe?
Yeah. So that's a great case because people do have a sense that that's sort of a virtue. That's very much a Protestant virtue, actually. Mm. So you get that right out of Protestantism. So the way to think about it is that these aspects of our psychology are adapted to the institutional and ecological environments that we have to confront. So Chris Blattman and colleagues, political scientists and economists, University of Chicago, did this research in Liberia where they basically created a training course to try to increase the self-regulation of poor men, to try to make them more patient and more willing to defer gratification. The training worked, and they were able to show that on the psychological tests, men were willing to defer gratification more. And initially, this seemed to be a big success because the men were able to begin to develop little nest eggs of savings and things like that.
Right.
Okay, so that's working. But then it turns out that because the environment is so unstable, the men would get robbed or they'd get shaken down by the police or something would happen, and they'd lose their complete nest egg. Hmm. So they wouldn't get the pleasure that would have come from indulging in that. So that's one way, and you need a stable environment where you can preserve that savings, and you need the chance that you're going to be alive when you get a chance to take advantage of it. Otherwise, it's better to consume now when you're sure you're going to get something out of it. The other thing that varies across societies is in a lot of cases, if I accumulate much, my relatives are going to come and ask for it, essentially. Mm. So will die, there'll be a funeral, or there'll be a wedding. So what I do, one way to deal with any kind of rising surplus is just to give it away, have a party or give it to others. And the way people think about that, or maybe not consciously, but the way it ends up functioning, is that you're storing your surplus in the goodwill and relationships you have with others.
Right.
So when you're in need, you don't have to have a nest egg. Your nest egg is scattered amongst all these friends and relatives and close contacts that you've cultivated over long periods of time.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And I, to some degree, I've studied that a little bit in Hasidic Jewish communities. And there's a that phenomena is very, very notable there, interestingly enough. The book is fascinating. It's called The Weirdest People in the World, How the West Became Psychologically Peculiar and Particularly Prosperous. We've been speaking with the book's author, Harvard University professor Joe Henrich. Joe, really appreciate your time today.
Okay. Well, it's great to be with you.
So Rudy Giuliani is not having a particularly good week. First, he claimed that he was almost killed at a grocery store. Then the surveillance video came out and someone patted him on the back. He claimed that he was hit so hard that the person standing next to him almost fell down. And then the video came out and all of it was untrue. So that was not a great start to the week for Rudy Giuliani. Then Cassidy Hutchinson testified that Rudy Giuliani wanted a pardon from Donald Trump around the time of the January 6th riots. And Rudy Giuliani accidentally admitted to that request. And I'm going to show you the message. He subsequently deleted the tweet. So let's go piece by piece. First and foremost, here is Cassidy Hutchinson on Tuesday saying Rudy Giuliani and Mark Meadows, they both wanted pardons related to January 6th.
Did Rudy Giuliani ever suggest that he was interested in receiving a presidential pardon related to January 6th?
He did.
Ms. Hutchinson, did White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows ever indicate that he was interested in receiving a presidential pardon related to January 6th?
Mr. Meadows did seek that pardon, yes, ma'am.
So very, very clear, Rudy wanted a pardon and Mark Meadows wanted a pardon. Okay, fine. So Tuesday night, Rudy Giuliani tweets, once again, the January 6th Committee of Russian Collusion Liars suborned perjury from Cassidy Hutchinson. I specifically told President Trump I did not want or need a pardon. I also have witnesses to corroborate that she and the committee are perpetrating yet another lie. Okay. And then on Wednesday, Rudy doubled down, but he unfortunately admits to the entire thing. Rudy tweets, the January 6th witch hunt cabal has now exceeded even its prior fraudulent. Strange grammar. Okay. The last witness was a reckless liar. Contrary to her false testimony, she was never present when I asked for a pardon. she says that you slapped your wife, sir. She was not there when I slapped my wife. I didn't slap my wife. Then Rudy says, actually, I told the president I did not want or need one. He then subsequently deleted that tweet. Not going particularly well for Rudy Giuliani. Now, one explanation would be he's just confused. What he meant by she wasn't there when I asked for a pardon is he never asked for a pardon. Maybe that's actually what he meant. But it doesn't look particularly good when you say she wasn't there when I did the thing she accuses me of doing, and then you delete the tweet. All very, very strange. And again, put the people under oath. Get Rudy there and have him testify under oath. Get everybody there and have them contradict her claims under oath. I don't for a second. Listen, when you're asked about things from a year and a half ago, you are stressed now when you're being asked the questions. It was a stressful time then. I am completely sympathetic to the notion that there will be details that could be off in this testimony. I think that applies to the friendly witnesses. I think that applies to the hostile witnesses. I think that that's perfectly plausible. But right now, we have the under oath testimony of a very composed Cassidy Hutchinson. And then we have the confusing and contradictory and sometimes bizarre admissions and subsequent deletions reacting to her claims. Put these people under oath, and we will evaluate their claims with all of the same consideration and seriousness that we're evaluating the claims made by Cassidy Hutchinson, period. All right, this is really weird. Many of you have asked me to react to this. Podcaster Joe Rogan, on whose program I've appeared two times, now seems to essentially be endorsing the dangerous, radical, unhinged Republican governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis. Now, we're going to look at what Joe Rogan said. But one of the important things to keep in mind is it's not just about, oh, Rogan likes DeSantis. There's another aspect to this, which is Rogan has been insisting that he's like a progressive guy, that his policy ideas are most in line with someone like a Bernie Sanders. So when you see someone who says, I really am like a Bernie guy in a lot of ways, when you see them say, I like DeSantis, you have to ask questions like, is it not true that his policies most align with Bernie because Bernie and DeSantis are basically polar opposites? Or does he not even really understand what these people's policies are and he's going on personality? I don't know the answer to any of these questions, but let's take a look at the video clip. Here is Rogan saying, DeSantis, DeSantis.
Didn't Elon Musk come out recently for DeSantis?
Yeah, I think Ron DeSantis would work as a good president. Mm-hmm. I mean, what he's done for Florida has been admirable.
Look at, I feel like I'm doing breaking news right now. Yeah. That wasn't even on purpose.
I feel like what he did for Florida, a lot of people gave him a lot of grief, but ultimately he was correct. He was correct when it comes to like deaths. He was correct when it comes to protecting our vulnerable populations. He was correct in terms of distribution of monoclonal antibodies. And he was furious when the government tried to pull those. Mm-hmm. They were trying to pull very effective treatments. You know, he is...
Now, just as a quick fact check, the government wasn't trying to pull it. What the government started to realize was that its effectiveness was diminishing. And it may not be the best course of action in some cases. But it really has nothing to do with the bigger picture here. Let's listen.
Not perfect. He's a human being. But what he's done is stand up for freedoms. And people think that this was some weird gaslighting shit that went on where people equated freedom and saying the word freedom to like right-wing bigotry and hate is so strange.
Well, sometimes that is exactly what they meant by it. So there's two parts, okay? How did DeSantis do as Florida governor? And then what about the prospect of Ron DeSantis as president of the United States? So, Florida, despite being one of the top tourism states in the country, no thanks to DeSantis. Like, it's not because of DeSantis that people go to the Gulf Coast of Florida, to the beaches, to the Atlantic Coast of Florida, to the beaches, to the various theme parks and resorts in Orlando, to Miami Beach. That has nothing to do with DeSantis. Florida has some great tourism attractions. And despite that, Florida ranks 33rd in opportunity, 26th in crime, 41st in access to health care. 20% of Floridians have no health insurance. And importantly, that's all been pretty similar with DeSantis as governor. So DeSantis is handed this tourism-rich state, and he doesn't improve any of those disastrous numbers. Now, in terms of the political positions of Ron DeSantis, first of all, Ron DeSantis is against legalizing recreational marijuana. Isn't this like a non-starter for Rogan? Rogan correctly supports legalization. I agree with Rogan on that completely. The DeSantis view on that issue is so antiquated. Wouldn't it be a disqualifying position for someone like Joe Rogan evaluating a candidate? Does Rogan know about that? Maybe he does. Maybe he doesn't. DeSantis is just straight up against abortion. He's just against abortion, period. That's it. Another retrograde, antiquated worldview. Rogan has daughters. Wouldn't he want in certain situations that to be an option, at least if his daughters ever needed to avail themselves of such a medical treatment? I mean, none of it's making any sense. And then, of course, you just go deeper and DeSantis is wrong on, you know, all but like a few issues that he comes across. DeSantis was against the Iran nuclear deal. He said it was a bad deal that would degrade national security. In fact, the deal worked really well until Donald Trump stepped up and just said, we're out of the deal, even though Iran didn't violate the deal. I mean, just terrible what Donald Trump did. The deal was working fine. It wasn't, no deal is perfect, but it was working well. DeSantis is opposed to all gun safety regulations. The NRA has rated DeSantis as an A+. Now, maybe Rogan likes that. For me, it's completely despicable. DeSantis called for a full and complete repeal of Obamacare with, of course, like all of these Republicans, no real substantive and plausible plan for how to get people health care. And as I mentioned, 20% of Floridians have no health insurance. One out of five Floridians does not have health insurance. DeSantis was opposed to deferred action for childhood arrivals. That's known as DACA. DACA refers to, you're 7 years old, your parents come to the United States illegally. It's not your fault. You're seven. You go where your parents take you. You then go to school and then you go to high school and blah, 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 blah. And what we should be doing is saying, this is really your country. you should be allowed to stay. We're going to defer action because you were a childhood arrival. Even many Republicans are okay with that. DeSantis is against it. And DeSantis has a zero rating from the Human Rights Campaign for his voting record on LGBT related issues and legislation. Everything I know about Rogan is that Rogan is not homophobic and that Rogan believes that everybody should be treated with dignity and respect and is for gay marriage and on and on. And DeSantis has a zero rating. So when it comes to Rogan on something like this, does Rogan not know about the political positions? Does Rogan just go on personality? Does Rogan just go on rhetoric? I don't know the answer, but it is bizarre for someone who says I'm like most aligned with someone like Bernie to say DeSantis would be a good president. It's weird. And I don't know what the explanation is. And I don't know how much Rogan knows about what Ron DeSantis does and stands for. But that's where we are right now. And of course, Rogan's got a huge audience. There are people who will hear this and go, yeah, I guess DeSantis. I don't know. DeSantis is good. As I've said before, DeSantis is like a Trump, but he's less incompetent. And that makes him much more dangerous. Scary stuff. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here's a caller dipping us further into the black hole of Spanish pronunciations that I sometimes do on the show.
David, sir, this is a reply to your discussion of the pronunciation of Spanish language words.
Please.
In my experience, it's a no-win situation. I have a friend, Felipe Cervantes.
Right.
Who is originally from Chile, yet he often argues with my friend Ernesto Delgado,
okay,
who is from Mexico,
right,
about who is the best chess player in history. Felipe believes it is José Capablanca,
right,
but Ernesto disagrees. So what are you going to do, right? In the end, though, they were able to settle their differences over some cerveza and enchiladas. So all's well that ends well, I suppose. All right. Take care, my friend. Bye.
Yeah, no, I understand that. You know, it's one of these things where if you say Capablanca, you look at, dude, don't you speak Spanish? Why are you saying Capablanca? And then if you say Capablanca, then people say, well, dude, that's really jarring. Why? If you're speaking English, you don't need to do that. It is an absolute no win. It is the black hole of Spanish pronunciation. Thank you very much for pointing it out. We have a great bonus show for you today, but sadly, the stories are not exactly fun stories. A woman was shot dead in Manhattan while pushing a baby stroller. Horrifying story, which we will talk about. Four individuals have already been found and charged in that mass casualty tractor trailer death from Texas that I spoke to you about yesterday. And we are going to compare the sentence handed down, the prison sentence handed down to Ghislaine Maxwell compared to the sentence handed down to R. Kelly. Many writing in and saying, David, it seems as though R. Kelly got a disproportionately heavy sentence compared to Maxwell based on what they were charged with. What's going on here? We're going to talk about it and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. I will see you on the bonus show or otherwise on tomorrow's program.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
RCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
What the Supreme Court did today was to eviscerate the authority of the EPA to protect our planet, to deal with the four-alarm fire that is affecting every single part of the world that we live in.
In another 6-3 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court sharply limited the Environmental Protection Agency's power to regulate carbon emissions from power plants. It's a victory for big polluters, but a potential disaster for the planet. We'll speak to former EPA official Mustafa Ali as Ketanji Brown Jackson is sworn in as the Supreme Court's first black female justice. The Supreme Court also ruled President Biden can end the Trump era, Remain in Mexico program. We'll go to San Antonio, where 53 people seeking refuge in the United States died earlier this week after being confined to a sweltering tractor trailer in Texas, the deadliest human trafficking tragedy in U.S. history.
Any death that has to do with migrants is preventable. And in this case, it is both the attacks from our governor in Texas and the complicity and enabling of the Biden administration.
Plus, we speak to the Dutch physician, Dr. Rebecca Gompertz, who's dedicated her life to helping expand access to abortion, from providing them on ships in international waters to sending abortion pills around the world. We'll look at the growing fight in the United States over medical abortion.
I think this is not the moment anymore to stay within the law. This is the moment to make sure that women have access to safe abortions, despite the law and despite the fact that this, because this is such an unjust law that is creating so much social inequality and that will affect really the most poor women in the country.
This is over 180 people are arrested in Washington, D.C., protesting the Supreme Court overturning Roe. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court's voted to sharply limit the Environmental Protection Agency's power to regulate carbon emissions from power plants. The court's 6-3 ruling in the case of West Virginia versus EPA is seen as a major victory for the fossil fuel industry and a result of a decades-long attempt to limit the regulation of corporations. Liberal Justice Elena Kagan slammed the decision, writing for the dissent, quote, "The court appoints itself, instead of Congress or the expert agency, the decision maker on climate policy. I cannot think of many things more frightening," unquote. Joining the majority opinion was Trump appointee Justice Amy Coney Barrett, whose father helped lead the American Petroleum Institute for two decades. We'll have more on the Supreme Court and the climate crisis after headlines. Environmental groups have filed a pair of lawsuits seeking to block the Biden administration from restarting lease sales for oil and gas wells on public lands. Together, the lawsuits seek to protect more than 140,000 acres in several western states. In April, President Biden called on the U.S. to expand fossil fuel drilling to offset a spike in fuel costs linked to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Public Citizen President Robert Weissman said in response, quote, "Selling off more public lands for drilling might help big oil, but it won't lower gas prices and it will worsen climate chaos." In Lisbon, Portugal, hundreds of protesters marched Thursday outside the UN Ocean Conference demanding meaningful action to halt pollution, protect marine life, and slow the warming of the Earth's seas. The conference brought together some 7,000